Where have all the good men gone? We're hearing more and more young women lament the lack of mature, godly men. One says, the guys I dated were more like the kids I babysat than the dads who drove me home. Research and observation increasingly point to the fact that it's taking longer and longer for our boys to mature into responsible, godly manhood. What are the factors that contribute to this reality? Are our current youth ministry and parenting strategies working to remedy the situation? And what can we do in our churches and homes to help prepare our boys to become godly men and leaders? We'll be talking with youth pastor Chris Walker about what he's discovered in his research and ministry about how to disciple our boys into maturity on this practical and informative episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Bueller here, and we are recording in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania, the Universal headquarters. I'm actually flying solo. Jason's not here with us today. Chris Wagner's here.
Good morning.
Yep, Chris is here, so he's going to join in the discussion. And it's going to be a great discussion today. Before we get to that, something I read this morning that Danny Kwan over in Horsham, Pennsylvania, sent to me. I really am thankful that Danny sent this because I love David Brooks. And Danny and I talk about David Brooks every now and then. But David Brooks had an article in the New York Times this week that I think applies really well to what our topic's going to be today. Before we get to that, let me tell you about the article. It's titled, Five Lies Our Culture Tells. I just sent it this morning to all of my kids, and my daughter-in-law and son-in-law. I said, this is a quick and easy read. You need to look at this. And what Brooks does in this is here's five. I'm going to tell you what they are real quickly. Career success is fulfilling. That totally goes against, you know, the gospel and what we hear in the gospel. I can make myself happy. He says this is the lie of self-sufficiency, and he works that out a little bit. It's not a long article, just a couple of pages. Third one is life is an individual journey. And, boy, he steps on sacred ground here when he says this is the lie. Books like Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You'll Go Tell. That's a dangerous thing to say as graduation time is coming up, because I know when I go into Barnes & Noble around, you know, May and June, that thing's right on the front, stacks and stacks, and people are buying that. Fourth, you have to find your own truth. We just know how dangerous and that is, and how it undermines human flourishing and the advancement of God's kingdom. And then lastly, rich and successful people are worth more than poor and less successful people. So that's an article we want to send people to. Again, Five Lies Our Culture Tells by David Brooks. And I thought that ties in well in the beginning here, Chris, because we have a guest today who is a friend of mine and who happens to be the youth pastor at our church, Westminster Presbyterian Church in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. His name's Chris Walker. Chris.
Good to see you, Walt.
Thanks for coming. Yeah. So, Chris, just a little bit of background here. How long have you been at Westminster?
Well, I've been a member there about 10 years. I've been the youth pastor about six.
Okay. And you were, that's an interesting story, because that's a story a lot of youth workers have, right? They, like, a member for 10 years, mm-hmm. Then they raise their hand, they ask to go to the restroom, and they didn't realize someone asked, we're looking for a youth worker.
Yeah,
hey.
That's right.
But Chris has been there for a few years. Before that, you were a school teacher, correct?
That's right. That's right. Teaching at Veritas Academy.
And what did you teach?
Well, it's a small Christian school, so whatever they needed.
I gotcha.
Yeah, but mostly Bible, history, some apologetics, Latin, Greek.
Bus driver, janitor.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Did those things sometimes.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Man, Latin and Greek together, that's awesome. So, and that's an indicator of one of the reasons why I love chatting with you, because you're well-read, which I wish, you know, more of us in youth ministry were well-read. This is why we have our CPYU reading and discussion group. And you take things seriously, I know, and you embarked on a journey a few years ago for your doctor of ministry degree.
That's
Talk
right.
about that, where you did that and what the topic was and what got you into that.
Sure, yeah. So I did my doctor of ministry degree at Westminster Theological Seminary over here in Philadelphia, and started 4 years ago taking classes in the summer, doing work there, and then working on the project or dissertation throughout the rest of the year. And they send you one of these forms, and it's kind of an interesting process where the first thing I had to do when I started the program was make a decision on what my dissertation would be on, which I wasn't really prepared to do that early on. But I thought, well, what do I care about? What's a topic that's going to be practical for my ministry and that I'm passionate about? And the answer to that really is pretty easy, and that's discipling young men. And so I knew pretty quickly I wanted to head in that direction. And I'm fortunate enough in my life to have had men who spoke into my life and did quite a bit as far as discipling me, training me, and did a lot of focus on leadership and growing as a leader. And that's something that our young men desperately need. And so kind of out of those desires and some early reading conversations with professors there, I decided to really focus on, okay, how do we prepare teen young men to be ready for leadership in their families and in their churches when they grow up?
Yeah. So we always talk here about the difference between the biblical narrative and the cultural narrative. What mm-hmm. I just read from Brooks
mm-hmm.
really summarizes a lot of the main, mm-hmm. I guess, thesis statements, beliefs, worldview, mm-hmm. you know, foundational beliefs related to the cultural narrative. And, of course, in discipleship, we're trying to communicate the biblical narrative and,
that's right.
and get young men and young women to embrace that, adults as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I read this and as you think about what you researched, what were some of the realities in the cultural narrative that you discovered that really have pushed on
mm-hmm.
kids that we need to be aware of? Because
yeah.
I always say reality demands a response,
yep.
and unless
yep.
we know the reality, we can't respond. And I think sometimes we're well-intentioned in our discipleship efforts in youth ministry, but we're not really using them to target and undermine perhaps
yep.
or bring truth where the cultural narrative is winning.
Yep, yep. Great question. I'll share two things maybe. First, some observable facts about our culture and then digging into maybe some of the trends behind those. First, if you look at some just statements of fact about our culture, you see a growing delay in adulthood or extended adolescence, as social commentators like to call it. Saw one article just recently that adolescence now is declared to last until 24.
Yeah.
You see facts of more 18 to 34-year-olds live with their parents than are living with a spouse or partner right now. So you're seeing some cultural facts that are saying we're not getting to maturity, responsibility. Even you get, adulting, the hashtag,
yeah.
Which is universally negative, this idea that we're going to keep away from responsibility in adulthood. So that's a cultural trend that's happening right now. And we say, well, why is that happening? But as I look at it as well, there's this trend of putting off maturity, responsibility, adulthood, leadership. We're seeing that more starkly with men, with boys, than we are with girls. And I think there's a whole, whole bunch of reasons. Again, we can talk about that.
Yeah, I'd love to do that.
But that's something that churches are talking about, a dearth of male leadership. It just anecdotally, when I mentioned my topic in our bulletin on Sunday, it was listed. And immediately I had two dads come up to me and say, I've got daughters and there's no men that are worth dating out there. You're seeing this one quote by one young woman in her 20s in an article I read said, the guys I have available to date are more like the kids I babysat than the dads who drove them home.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're seeing these cultural realities, and we're starting to say, okay, well, what's feeding this? Why are we at this place? And I think there's a lot we could talk about. I think some of the things that are specifically going on. One, you see a dramatic increase in self-focus, self-gratification, self-expression. That's a part of our culture.
Yeah, that's what Brooks was talking
and
about.
And that's what Brooks is talking about. But you think about it, and you start to say, okay, well, if happiness, if our culture tells us that happiness, meaning, identity, fulfillment is going to come from self-gratification and self-expression, what role do things like maturity, responsibility, leadership have in that type of a culture? And it was interesting. I was sitting at lunch with a young man from our church. He's 29 years old. I just mentioned my topic, and he's a deep thinker. He immediately started to engage in it. And he said, yeah, he said, you know, what I see with a lot of my friends is that they know that getting in a relationship with someone is going to require them to care about someone else. And so they'll just won't get in a relationship. Because that would require them to care about someone else. And so you're starting to uncover these. If the focus is on me, my gratification, expressing myself, maturity and responsibility require you to set aside gratification, instant gratification, self-expression. And so they're mutually exclusive trends.
Yeah.
And so what's really interesting about this is you can go back to the 80s and 90s, and you're already seeing concerned social commentators talking about the increase in self-gratification, individualism, this radical individualism that I define my life, I define myself, and sort of forecasting the social problems that are going to come if our culture continues down that path. And here we are in 2019, and I think we're seeing that. So that's a huge trend.
Yeah. Something you just said there I want to follow up on, and Chris Wagner. We have two Chris's in here, Chris Walker, Chris Wagner, so that makes it really difficult.
Letters
different. Two letters different than the last name. So weigh in if you have a question, sure. Chris Wagner. But one of the things you said there was going back, you know, when you look at the 70s and the 80s. I was a sociology major. I know you took sociology classes. And so you're always listening to the folks who would be, I guess, the long view says, boy, they were quite prophetic.
Mm-hmm.
But the immediate view when they were speaking was, you know, they were much maligned. That's the tendency,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So people speak up prophetically and people, you know, that's hogwash. You're crazy. That's mm-hmm. not true. But then we see it down the road. You even see that in communications theory, like when we talk here about Marshall McLuhan, you know, first we shape our tools and our tools shape us, mm-hmm. which I know you mm-hmm. in your work here, you talk a little bit about forms and how they shape
mm-hmm.
or misshape.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just say something about that, because you, when you see that, because you're still a relatively young guy. How old are you?
I'm 34.
34. Okay, so you're still relatively young. And I love when I get to engage with younger guys who get it about that prophetic edge, you know. Mm-hmm. Can you say something about that, just about how we can listen to the people who are more prophetic in our time? Because mm-hmm. I just thought that was a brilliant aside there. I don't know if that makes sense to you or not. But
yeah, no. Well, I think it's an interesting question, because you're always there's so many voices that are speaking. And it's not always apparent in, say, today's terms, which are the voices that are prophetic and which are the voices that don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes it takes 20 years to recognize which are which. But sometimes I think it is easy to figure that out, and that is who's willing to speak hard truths that go against the grain of our culture, that require sacrifice, that require us to do things that are difficult. They require us to go against the grain of the cultural narrative. Typically, those are voices we want to at least give a closer listen to, because they're voices that are going to be harder for the culture to listen to. But if they're speaking outside of that cultural narrative, they may just be able to see something that when you're swimming in the soup, it's harder to see.
Yeah, I like that. I'll put you on the spot here. Are there any of those voices you can think of right now that you would recommend youth workers listen to? And the reason I ask that is, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, maybe another way of asking the question would be, you know, if this particular man or this particular woman writes a book, I'm reading it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you know they're one of those voices. Are there any of those out there now that you would?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I'll say two things. One, there's a book actually that you loaned me.
That's right. You pilfered my shelves.
I pilfered your shelves.
Yeah,
that's
right.
I did.
Yeah.
But it was called Spiritual Formation in Emerging Adulthood. Cetrin and Kiesling are the two authors. And I sort of picked this up toward the end of my doctor ministry program, just sort of say, okay, is there anything here that would be helpful, anything that I'm missing? And I found myself engrossed in the book, found it myself personally challenged and encouraged. It's one of those titles that sounds more like a dissertation title than it does something helpful. But what these guys did was walk through for sort of late high school through early 20s, what are the key questions people in this stage are wrestling with, and what are key truths they need to know? Lots about just discipline, habit. You think, again, what are these cultural trends? Self-gratification, self-expression. And here these guys are focusing on sort of the spiritual disciplines of habit, of character formation. And what does that look like in developing a moral character? What does that look like as we start to think about vocation? What does that look like as we start to think about family life, marriage, and sexuality? And so they break this down into these different key life categories. And I just found it spiritually refreshing and just bringing voices to the table that maybe not everyone would have heard and listened to. So that book was tremendously encouraging and helpful.
That's a good recommendation. You know, one of the things that frustrates me more than anything else in our youth ministry world right now, because I think it's contributing to the very problem you've identified and you're working to address, as well as numerous others, is our, this is going to sound really weird, but let me explain, is our commitment to bring kids to Jesus. Because it typically stops there. All we want to do is see kids come to Jesus, but we don't talk to them. This is discipleship, about what it really means to follow Jesus. So as you mentioned, those different areas there, you know, vocation, sexuality, we would talk about play and other things as well. That's so necessary. This is why I really believe what you have identified and what you're writing about here, what you wrote about. And by the way, we both, Chris and I both said, you got to put this in a book. So we're going to push you.
I appreciate it.
For that. This is why it's so important, because we need, as people in youth ministry and as parents, to learn about this.
That's right.
You know,
that's
this is what real life is about. So I just got the high sign here from Chris Wagner. We need to take a break. So we're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation with Chris Walker about where have all the good men gone and how in our youth ministries we can disciple boys into becoming men. Tens of thousands of kids have been trained by their parents and youth workers to think Christianly about music and media with our How to Use Your Head to Guard Your Heart 3D Guide to Making Wise Media Choices. This easy-to-use teaching tool needs to be in your youth ministry toolbox if you desire to teach your students to integrate their faith into all of life. Jesus calls us to follow Him, and that includes following Him into the 6 to 9 hours a day of screen time that shape and mold the beliefs and behaviors of our kids. To learn more about our 3D Media Evaluation Guide and to order a copy for every member of your youth group, go to our website at cpyu.org. Teach your kids to engage with media to the glory of God. Well, we're talking on Youth Culture Matters today with my friend Chris Walker, who is a youth pastor and has just completed his doctoral work, Doctor of Ministry degree at Westminster Theological Seminary. And congratulations on a successful defense, right? Two weeks ago?
That's right. Yes, thank
you.
So
when do we have to start calling you doctor? I mean, is it graduation?
That's one of those questions. I don't know if there's a right answer.
Yeah.
You know, they call you doctor right in the room.
Yes.
There's no more requirements.
Yes.
You know, who knows when the diploma will come in the mail or whatever.
Do you have to walk at a graduation?
The graduation's the 23rd of May, I think. I probably won't make it over there in the middle of our transition. I'm preaching that Sunday. We've got Presbytery that weekend.
Okay.
And you're required to go 2 days up to the Allentown area for the graduation practice and the graduation. So I don't know that.
Allentown?
Yeah, Souderton.
Souderton. Okay,
Area.
Oh, great. So. Good. Well, congratulations on
that.
I'm so happy you did this. And when you were telling me a couple of years ago about, you know, your problem, and by the way, this is how I think about it. I don't know if they do this at Westminster. At Gordon Conwell, with our DMEN students, mm-hmm. we have them identify a problem to address. Mm-hmm. So same thing, mm-hmm. right? Very practical.
Very similar, yep. That's right.
Yeah, so this
That's
is right. what I'm really excited about. The fruit of this is it's not just empty academic exercise. It's
That's
a
right.
very practical
That's
degree
right.
where you, in your current ministry setting, address a particular problem you're seeing, mm-hmm. you've identified, and you work to develop a practical theology that's based in good theology, good biblical
That's right.
theology to address it. And so I'm excited about this. So you talked in the problem about some of the cultural trends
That's right.
that have been at work from at least the 60s and the 70s to bring about extended adolescence. You talked in the first segment we did here about this increased emphasis on individualism, self-gratification, and self-expression. But you listed some others, and
yeah,
I'm curious
yeah.
as to if you'd share those.
Yeah, absolutely.
You need to be aware of this.
There's three other key trends that identify as behind this delaying of adulthood, putting off responsibility. So one would be that youth has really become an ideal to enjoy and maintain rather than a stage of preparation that we pass through. I'll come back to that in a second. The next one is the loss of boundaries, structures, and authority in society that really leave teens without the needed guidance and support to mature. And I think about the way I think about that is imagine you're trying to rock climb without rock. You know, what's the structure you're working with? What are your handholds? What's your rope to hold on to? You know, what would rock climbing be without that? Or I think imagine you're going to try to play a board game, but there's no rules and no one there to show you how to play. And I think in our culture, we've eliminated moral authority and moral structure. We've moved to moral relativism. But as you know, Chap Clark is a name you know, and in his book Hurt, he identifies just the way many teens are growing up without adult and parental support and influence in a lot of different areas. So you take away the people who are showing you how to do it. You take away the boundaries and the structure.
Yeah.
And how are you left to play the game? So that's what we're getting at there.
Yeah, can I throw something in there? Because we're yeah. both, you know, like sports fans. I know
sure.
you like sports.
Yeah. yeah.
And to use another, you know, example from our culture, it's interesting to me that this slide has been taking place for a while. And I remember, you know, 20, 25 years ago when I first started to look at the postmodern swing and write seminars on mm-hmm. that. This was one of the main tenets and practical outcomes of this worldview shift that we were seeing. But it's interesting in sports. Have you noticed this? I mean, we need rules. While rules have and boundaries have been stretched in the culture, it seems like we're getting tighter and tighter in sports on wanting to make sure that the rules are enforced.
Yeah, right.
Even better than they were the year prior, the right. season prior.
Right.
So I think about, you know, we're in baseball season now, and instant replay and mm-hmm. things like that. It's mm-hmm. it's interesting. You don't see guys, managers or players really arguing with umpires anymore like they used to, because they could just go check a call, you know,
right.
because we have that. And then every year at the NFL meetings,
what is a catch?
Yeah, what is a catch? But the owners are constantly going through, you know, the rule issues, and there's lots of dialogue about that.
Mm-hmm.
And every year we start the season with new rules that we all have to be.
Yeah, there's a, in sports, there's a certain inherent understanding that if we don't define the rules clearly, chaos ensues.
Yeah, and
That's right.
we're making the rules tighter and tighter. And I
yeah.
wish we could, you know, learn that a little bit. The unfortunate yeah. thing with that, just as an aside as well, is that the judicial system, the legal mm-hmm. system, law enforcement have to increase
mm-hmm.
when our own self-governing and our
That's
own
right.
self-regulation decrease.
That's right.
Because we're heading, as you said, towards, you know, anarchy and more. And Chris, you said moral chaos, mm-hmm. you know, so we need mm-hmm. to be aware of that. Sorry
yeah.
to interrupt you there.
No, I think that's
that was
really
just
helpful.
A thought on that, because there's an irony there.
That's
you
right.
know, that imbalance. So,
yeah. Well, that was the last key trend was just that parenting practices have focused on protecting and guarding children, but not on preparing them to mature and lead as adults. And this would be, you know, your helicopter parenting, your snowplow parenting, the parenting practices that's working to make everything as good as possible for my child, but is not really giving responsibility, asking responsibility, maturity, and doing things that are going to help prepare your children for adulthood. So those are kind of the key trends. Yeah. And
but before you go back to the youth, would you say something on that last one just about the first thing that comes to mind all the time? Because I think about Leonard Sachs and his book, The Collapse of Parenting.
Right.
Paul Tripp and his book, Parenting, you know, which is a great book, by the way, that we highly recommend. Failure, the place of allowing your kids to fail, because that seems to be where people step in. Mm-hmm. You know, we had the story in the last couple of weeks about this college admissions scandal you know, trying to pave the way and paying lots of money for my kids to be advantaged and, you know, basically lying, cheating, stealing is what was behind that, a total loss of virtue. Mm-hmm. But what about failure? Because you're a dad. I mean,
Failure is the breeding ground of success, right? I don't even remember in the massive reading who it was. I think it was a quote in a book of one person who sort of sarcastically called today's parenting the sanitized world where there would never be a skinned knee or a C in school. And the point was, we're trying to keep our kids from having any pain, any failure, anything that would go poorly. And so we're going to do everything we can either to prevent them from even trying something in the first place in case they might fail, or to mop up in the background in case they did fail and mitigate any consequences there. Whereas if you think about life, first of all, if failure's off the table, you're not going to take any risks. You're not going to make decisions that have any chance of any pros or cons. You're only going to go where there's all pros. So you're eliminating most of life if you're going to take all risk and potential failure. But for young people, failure is essential. And you think in multiple cases here. First of all, if you have parents who are going to run everything and keep everything just the way their kids need it, so their kids don't have to do anything, when does that stop? You know, I just heard a spot the other day about parents. I think Al Mohler mentioned this on the briefing about parents who are now calling workplaces to mitigate for their 20 and early 30 somethings who are getting fired or negative reviews. And parents are trying to. So when does it stop? If you're doing it in grade school, how do you not do it in high school? Not do it in college? When does that stop? And when it does stop, where does that leave your child if they've never failed and never had to work through these things? You know, I'm sure you can think back to this well, but when I think about my time in high school and college, it's the things that I was responsible for and had to either learn to work through failure learn to seek help on my own and look for resources to work through it. Those were where I really grew.
Yeah.
That's how I really grew it.
I remember my dad, two of the things my dad often said. And by the way, thank you for looking at me and going, I think you can remember this.
Yeah.
I think you can think back. At 62. But I remember two of the things my dad said. He said to me, if you ever want to try smoking, just let me know and I'll set you up. where he's going with this. And he'd say, you will smoke what I give you to smoke, and you will smoke as much of it as I give you to smoke.
Right.
And in other words, what he was saying was, fair warning, you're going to be sick as a dog and you'll never want to smoke again, you know. So that was one. The other one was, he would say to me, if you ever get in trouble and you wind up having to, you get arrested and you're put in a cell, just settle down and sleep because I'm not coming to get you till the next morning.
Right.
You know, you're going to suffer the consequences of, you know, of what you did. So I never wound up in the cell. But I hate to tell you, Dad, I did try smoking without your, So that's good. I was just thinking, you know, it's the great irony of this is with parenting, if we don't allow our children to fail, we're actually setting them up for monumental failure.
That's right. Absolutely.
And we need to wake up to this. So.
Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No,
Were you going to go back to the youth?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about youth as an ideal to enjoy and maintain. We see this in a whole a bunch of different ways. Gary Cross has written an interesting book called Boys to Men, and this is one of the key things he focuses on.
Chris's favorite group, by the way, Boys to Men.
There you go. he talks about the way advertising has used youth to sell product. and how our mainstream media has more and more sold growing up as a loss of freedom and youth as the glory days when we could do what we want. We had the freedom, the money, the time to do the things that we want to do. And so culturally, both you know, in advertising as well as in sort of TV shows, movies, in different ways that the culture speaks to us, youth is pictured as the time when we have and can do what we want to do, and adulthood is something to be avoided. And I think there's a number of things that make this believable. Sexuality and the huge focus on sexuality sells this. It makes this believable because youth is where you're attractive. It's where you're able to be involved sexually. The older you get, the more that moves away. In our culture, that's such a big deal for our culture right now that I think that reinforces this narrative.
Yeah.
But you think about even things like technology. Technology has become so pervasive in our culture. And what's the typical storyline? Well, the parent has to ask their teen how to use the new phone. A grandparent doesn't know how to use this device. They've got to go to the youth. And so as technology flourishes, it reinforces in our minds that youth actually know better how to navigate today's world because they can navigate technology better. I think this is being reinforced in a business sense, too. You read articles about startup businesses, about venture opportunities. And as one article that I read put it, the general wisdom in sort of startup businesses and investing is you never invest in someone older than 30, because it's the youth that has the fresh ideas that are worth considering. And I read a quote from one guy who said, if I'm going to go before a board of investors, I can't look like I'm married with 2.5 kids and a mortgage. Well, think about that for a second. Marriage, 2.5 kids, and a mortgage are the traditional markers of adulthood. And if you're going to be look like a successful opportunity to invest in, you can't have any of the markers of adulthood, traditional markers of adulthood. So you've got technology, you've got sort of investing, startup, new ideas, you've got sexuality, you've got all these trends that are reinforcing this idea that youth is where it's at. Youth is where our opportunities are, aging, getting into responsibility, adulthood, that ties us down and minimizes our opportunities. And so suddenly our culture is reinforcing in major ways this idea that youth is an ideal to enjoy and maintain.
Yeah.
And that doesn't even get at the obvious, like freedom from responsibility, money. Teens, as much as we talk about, they have lower wages or whatever. Teens have the most disposable money statistically
That's
of
true.
Any age group. So you've got freedom, you've got money available, you've got all of these different things, and suddenly the idea that adulting would be a negative thing to be avoided starts to make more and more sense.
Yeah. Boy, we do, as you talk about this, I don't think you use this term yet, but I know you believe this, that we idolize
that's right.
youth. I mean,
that's right.
an idol
that's
in
exactly
our culture
right
now. And so I think about some of the things, Chris Wagner, we've talked about here at CPYU, especially with marketing and, style and cool and all of that. So things like, as you're talking, Chris, I'm hearing in my mind, I'm thinking about, planned obsolescence. So the style, the cycle of style is running, a few years ago, like at The Gap, it was 6 weeks. We're going to totally change over because we want what we were selling 6 weeks ago to be obsolete,
right.
So people have to come in and get the latest and the greatest. And so this play on youthfulness, we also talk in our marketing stuff about age aspiration, that kids aspire to be seen as older, and be perceived as older than they are, feel like they're older than they are, treated like they're older than they are. So marketers, if you're marketing to a 12-year-old, you put a 16-year-old in the ad. And how when you hit the age of 21, now you aspire back.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and then, think about some of what we've tracked with here about, and I'm just throwing this out here to affirm everything you're saying, Chris, plastic surgery,
that's
non-medically
right.
prescribed,
that's right.
Non-necessary plastic surgery that's all about appearance and trying to look young. And, man, even just with style, I think about, it dawns on me every now and then, you know, at 62 years old, I think back and I go, man, I remember when my grandparents were this age.
Right. Yep.
And my grandmothers, they never, I won't say they never changed their clothes. They changed their clothes. Don't get me wrong. But they wore the same style of thing my whole life. They never changed that. It was utilitarian. And now it's all based on style. And with social media, this magnifies it. And so you see the evidence of this with the all the posts, you know, hey, look at me. Adults, kids, everybody, as we curate our kids, mm-hmm. curate ourselves. And it's mm-hmm. really is indicative of where we're at. And like you said early on, we swim in this soup ourselves, so mm-hmm. we tend to not see it.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's really important as we think about this is if you're so focused on enjoying youth, you're not going to be preparing to be a responsible adult later
yeah.
on. You know, as one student said to me, I don't want to get a job as a teenager. I'm going to have to do that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
You know, we start to put off the things we should be doing now to prepare us for a productive and God-honoring future so that we can enjoy youth and we don't miss out
yeah.
on it. And then we're just perpetuating adolescence. We're leaving ourselves unprepared.
Yeah. Gordy Williams, one of our Gordon Conwell guys who's tracking with us on Facebook mm-hmm. Live right now, he posted, he said, don't have gray hair on the stage at church. And there's a couple things in what Gordy said. He knows I'm going to go down this road. One is the whole worship of youth, as you've mm-hmm. said, and you can't have gray hair. And you watch some of these guys who are up on the quote-unquote stage, and you see that they've been, you know, it's like fashion consultants have worked
mm-hmm.
with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is that he uses the word stage, which is fairly common now.
Mm-hmm.
And we've really, Duffy Robbins and I, Mark Penner, we've talked about this. We want to have a podcast on this at some point, that the way we refer to our buildings, our architecture, they speak.
That matters.
And if we talk about a stage, we're talking about performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're trying to please the audience. You're mm-hmm. trying to draw the audience, please the audience, keep the audience,
mm-hmm.
which is so, I mean, I just don't see that lining up with the gospel and
yeah.
the costliness
right.
of faith, you know.
Right.
When we talk discipleship, Bonhoeffer talked about mm-hmm. this, you know, and I think we need to go back and recover that. Would you say, before we take a break here, I want to take a few minutes
yeah.
because we're going to come back after the break and talk about practical responses
yeah.
to this that you've discovered, which
sure.
are just great, how to prepare young men to be godly men and leaders. But some of the responses that we have right now, just
yeah.
would you go through those?
Yeah, let me just mention a couple of things that you can find. You know, from a secular perspective, there's three or four different ways people have responded because everyone's noticing these trends. One is to deny that it's a problem. And this is sort of a sociological extended adolescence, you know, taking longer to get to adulthood. It's not a problem. It's just a fact. The problem, as one person said in response to this, is if everyone's aiming at adulthood and it's just taking us a little longer to get there, no problem. That's not what we have in our culture. We have a rejection of adulthood
yeah.
and responsibility. Another response is to say, look, this is really an issue of brain development. And you've, I'm sure, heard of, you know, prefrontal cortex develops later. You've got teens and early 20s where their decision-making capacity in their brain is not fully functioned. But here's the problem with this perspective. We can look at brain scans and see that the prefrontal cortex is not fully developed, but why is it not fully developed? Our brain is a muscle, just like our other muscles. It develops what is being used. And so I think our prefrontal cortex not being developed is a reflection of the fact that we're not giving and taking responsibility. It's not the cause. So to say, look, you can't give them responsibility, their prefrontal cortex isn't developed, is like saying, oh, he's got weak muscles, he better not go to the gym and try to work out. You're flipping it around. And as one author put it, they said, we know that your brain scan, your brain development changes just by using a yo-yo for 2 weeks. How much more would your brain develop if you were being given responsibility and expected to function in these different ways? So we have to be careful with the brain,
yeah.
brain development. It
can I'm not going to push back on you. I'm going to
yeah.
affirm you here
yeah.
because I think we need to realize this, and I like the way you couch it in the language of excuse, that we just say,
right.
this is the way it is, we're going to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when I talk to parents, I'll say, hey, that, you know, we do see that the brain develops a little later than what we thought, but the exercise component that you're talking about is huge, giving kids
mm-hmm.
opportunities to make decisions,
right.
to fail,
mm-hmm.
To succeed,
right.
to understand moral implications. And the reality is that, you know, well, an example of this would be if you go back and watch, like, on the History Channel, you know, when I'm flicking around, I am stunned when I watch, like, these shows on World War II or the Korean War, and that you've got, you know, a fighter plane or a bomber that the entire crew is between the ages of 18 and 21 years old.
Yep, that's right.
Could you imagine doing something like that now?
Right.
Because we just haven't prepared. Yeah. You know, so that transition that used to exist, you know, that was understood, you know, from high school into adulthood or from adolescence into adulthood, we've lost. So I think there is something to the brain scans, but what you're saying, totally on
track. It's clearly true. You know, that I wouldn't dispute the brain scans. The question is why.
Yeah, we've talked about this, like, with technology, with reading, you know, because there's a lot of young folks now who are saying, I just don't read. I'm not a reader. I can't read. But the brain studies have shown that if you read, if you say you're not a reader, but you read one book, the wiring in your brain fundamentally changes for 2 weeks.
That's right.
So the more you read, the more you can read.
We live in Lancaster County. Go out to any of our Mennonite farms. What you'll see is 10, 11, and 12-year-olds doing things that many 25-year-olds in the rest of our culture can't do or are unprepared to do. Why? Because they've been given responsibility and trained in this. So, so that's one another. So another response is really to emphasize the importance of hard work and responsibility. And this is really helpful. Fascinating study came out a few years ago. Tim Elmore over at Growing Leaders, he mentioned this Harvard study on what makes happy and successful adults. And then there were some, you know, obvious things in there, having a solid home growing up, having two parents around. One of the most interesting ones was required to do household chores as a child. It's fascinating comment. And what he pointed out was
I have young kids. That survey has come up in conversation
many times
since
that's
that
great.
Article.
Yeah.
Was
what released. I love about it, though, is it's talking about hard work. But it's a specific type of hard work, because the study said that working hard at sports or in practicing your violin doesn't produce the same results. Because the unique thing about chores is you're working hard for the sake of someone else. You're not working hard just for your own sake. And so there's something about training diligent hard work for the sake of your family, for the sake of your church, for the sake of the people around you, trains your responsibility, your maturity, your ability to function here in other ways. I think so. That's sort of a specific practical side of this. On the more philosophical side of it, Thomas Hines written a book called The Rise and Fall of the American Teenager, and he traces how the idea of adolescence or the idea of a teenager started when we said teens are being exposed to too much. We need to find ways to protect them and give them a chance to sort of grow up in a safe environment. And his point is that that experiment has really failed because in that space, we haven't given teens responsibility. We haven't given them any vision for what it looks like to be a meaningful member of society with responsibility, with an ability to produce, to contribute. And so unlike all the rest of history, the 20th century took teens and didn't give them responsibility. And it really hurt us. And so here's a secular sociologist saying the key is to give teens more opportunities for responsibility, where they can be mentored, where they can be, you know, brought along. He doesn't use the word discipleship, obviously, but you can put that word in there from a Christian perspective, and where they can have responsibility. Mm-hmm. So that would be another response. And there's some education related responses. Just how do we train leadership in a classroom setting, which are somewhat helpful. But they're not really going to go anywhere until you actually are involved in leadership and responsibility.
So those are some of the more mainstream approaches in the world. What about in the church? What did you find there?
Yeah, there's a couple things. You'd have what I call sort of the rally response, and that is you think of the Harris brothers and Do Hard Things, where you have Do Hard Things rallies. And you get thousands of teens come together and declare that we're going to, you know, buck the trends of youth and teens and accomplish great things. That's one approach. They're not the only ones doing things like that. And there's helpful things like along those lines. You know, those are helpful truths and trends. I'm always suspicious of sort of the rally format, at least for me. you go, you feel great, you feel like you're ready to conquer the world for about 48 hours, and then everything goes back to normal.
Yeah. You come home and your parents make you work on the farm.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't feel like you're going to change the world anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm kind of on the flip side to that is sort of the grassroots discipleship movement. You know, I think of a place like a Christian Service Brigade, which is really focused on forming mentoring relationships between older men and young men in churches. How do we use programs? How do we do anything we can to foster these mentoring relationships? And I think that's helpful. A lot of times there, some more guidance curriculum, some more things that could be paired with that would be helpful. But as a structure, it's a great structure. It's a biblical structure. So that's been another response. One of the sort of interesting ways that some people go is to talk about rites of passage. And they talk about cultures historically that have had rites of passage that sort of define when a young man becomes a man. There's several different authors have sort of tried to create some rites of passage that would help young men know, okay, when I complete this, you know, I'm a man. And I think what I find helpful in that response is not so much the rite or the ceremony or anything like that, but it comes back to how do people around me view me? Do they give me responsibility? Do they view me as a responsible, growing person who can contribute to this community? It comes back to those themes, and where that's evident, there's real benefit. And then obviously you've got other books on purity and sexual faithfulness. You've got books on growing to be a man. You've got books like A Man in the Mirror or the Masculine Mandate that can be sort of translated down to help help young men grow. So there's other books out there that are trying to do things like that. But I think those are some of the beginning responses, at least, that the church has made to part of the problem here.
Okay, so you've identified current responses. But what we want to get at after we come back from the break is, when you addressed all this, you know, the problem and its setting, now you've developed some responses.
Sure.
So we want to hear about that, because that's very helpful. So we'll take a break and be back and continue our conversation with Chris Walker. Here at CPYU, we continue to create resources designed to help youth workers encourage, educate, and equip parents to nurture their children in the faith as they grow up in a rapidly changing world. To that end, we've released a new installment in our easy-to-use, plug-and-play series of parent meetings we call Just Add Parents. This new installment is called Raising Marketing Savvy Kids. The meeting is designed to teach parents about the role marketing plays in shaping the beliefs and behaviors of kids, along with how to nurture their kids into thinking critically and Christianly about the 4,000 to 10,000 marketing messages they encounter every day. The meeting includes 3 video teaching segments, along with questions to facilitate lively small group discussion following each segment. Parents will learn how to teach their kids to use our simple 7 ad filtering questions. You can use this Just Add Parents resource during one parent meeting, or you can divide it up over the course of 3 parent meetings or even a weekend retreat for parents. To learn more about this new resource and to order your copy, visit us online at cpyu.org. Youth workers, we've got your parent meeting covered. All you need to do is just add parents.
Welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. We are speaking with Chris Walker about his dissertation about how to raise godly men. Chris, I have 2 young boys, and this is certainly a topic that I'm very interested in as I think about how to raise them and how to point them to Christ and how to turn them into godly men. So, through your dissertation work, you really looked at what are some of the key ways, things that we as parents can look to, things that we should be thinking about as we go in this process with our children. Can you talk to us a little bit about those?
Sure. Yeah. Well, as I start to look at Scripture and say, okay, what does the Bible have to say? Does the Bible say anything about young men growing into men? Does it say anything about a curriculum for becoming leaders? There's a couple things that jump to mind. First of all, you think, okay, well, Jesus is the example of a man and a leader. What does Scripture tell us about his process of growing up. And there's not a ton of detail, but we do have that nugget of gold that Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Most of our boys, you have boys in your household, you know, they grow in stature without much help. They're growing in stature pretty quickly. But that first comment of growing in wisdom, my advisor over at Westminster Seminary said, you know, that's an interesting comment. I wonder if there's some, you know, that deserves to be dug around in a little bit. So you start thinking about wisdom, and you go back to the Old Testament, and you think Proverbs, sort of the key book of wisdom. What is Proverbs? It's Solomon writing to his son, who's going to take the reins as a royal leader in Israel. And wisdom, Proverbs, is the curriculum for how to do that. And so these are just a couple of early connections to say, I think the Bible really speaks to wisdom as a core curriculum for growing as a potential man and leader. And if you look at wisdom, you know, break down Proverbs chapters 1-9 as sort of the introduction to wisdom, the introduction to the book of Proverbs. And I think of sort of picture the life of wisdom like a house that has a foundation and key pillars supporting it. And in Proverbs, as many people will know, we're told that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And not the beginning in the sense of like, okay, once you start with that, once you get that down, you can move on to other things. We mean beginning as in the foundation that you never move past. It always must be there. And so you start with this idea of the fear of the Lord, taking the Lord seriously and all of his glory and his power and who he is. And then if you start to work through Proverbs 1-9 in this introduction, I think three things will rise to the surface. One, how many times Proverbs tells his son to listen. Listen, my son. Listen, my son. Listen, my son. You're supposed to listen to the wise men around you. But then Proverbs 2 also highlights specifically, listen to the Lord, for the Lord is the one who gives wisdom. And so you have this humility to listen. Now listen to the men around you, listen to the Lord himself is sort of a key pillar, the humility to listen and learn. Second is trust. You have the classic passage in Proverbs 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding, and all your ways acknowledge him, and he will guide your paths. And so this idea of trusting the Lord, and then Proverbs 3 starts to break out different scenarios. When you're faced with temptation, what does it look like to trust the Lord? When you're faced with difficulty and discipline from the Lord, what does it look like to trust him? And it's building this key pillar of trusting the Lord. And then third, guard your heart. You've got the classic passage, you know, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. And you have the picture of the young man who's faced with sexual temptation, who's supposed to guard his heart, to know where temptation leads. And so you have these key pillars of listening to those around you, in particular to the Lord himself, trusting the Lord and guarding your heart, that are built on a foundation of fearing the Lord. And what I see this doing is creating sort of the heart that is the necessary foundation in order to grow in wisdom and leadership. In other words, you know, if I want to think about my teen men, my young men, I don't expect them to be a church elder at 16. You know, my goal in this project isn't to turn every 16-year-old into a 40-year-old ready, you know, mature leader in the church. My goal is to say, what do you need that's going to make you fertile ground for leadership growth in the future? What kind of person do you need? What are the things that need to be true of your heart, of your mind? What kind of habits and character formation need to be there so that as you grow, you're going to be ready for leadership? And what I see wisdom doing here is exactly that. This wisdom starting with the foundation of the fear of the Lord, and built on these pillars of the humility to listen to others and to the Lord, to trust the Lord, to guard your heart. That's sort of the character formation that's going to form the foundation that will allow young men to be ready and to be growing in this wisdom and this life that will prepare them for leadership. So that's sort of where I start. And then I think there's really two things you need to know. If you're going to get somewhere, you need to know where you're going and how to get there. Right? And this is maybe kind of obvious, but the first thing that a teen young man needs to know is, well, what is a man? What does a godly young man look like? And I remember the first time that I ran a Bible study for young men, really focused on godly manhood. We got to the end of the year, and I'm thinking, these are all kids who've grown up in the church. You know, Westminster is a conservative church. We've got good, solid families. This might be repetitive. But we got to the end of the first year, and I remember the high school senior looked at me and said, this was so good. No one has ever told me what a godly man was supposed to be like before. And I think this is a key need. And so what we do in our study is really break down what does godly manhood look like. We start in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. We look at Ephesians 5. We look at some other passages where the Bible talks about manhood. And we really look at man being called to leadership, a sacrificial leadership, where you sacrifice yourself for the sake of those that you're leading. A man is called to take responsibility. You see, you know, in the garden, Adam and Eve both sin, but Adam is the one whose sin leads to the fall of mankind. He's the one held responsible, if you will, addressed first. Romans says it was his sin, so there's a responsibility there. A man is called to work, right? In Genesis 2, why did God place him in the garden? To work the garden. There's a key there. And then a man is called to care for those who God entrusts to them, and really look particularly with an emphasis on a man called to trust and love his wife. And I think in Scripture, obviously, leadership you can look at a whole lot of different areas there. But a godly man is going to be specifically called to care for his wife. And so we break down these areas of sacrificial leadership, responsibility, work, and caring for those God's entrusted you, particularly your wife. And what does that look like? What is that? And of course, as we're talking to teen young men, we're going to also say, okay, well, how do you prepare to care for a wife? How do you interact with girls around you now? And what I really try to do is, for a lot of our young men, they've heard what they're not supposed to do. They know they're not supposed to look at pornography. They're not supposed to, you know, engage in sexual temptation. They're not supposed to do these things. But what are they supposed to do? What's the positive picture of how does a 16-year-old boy interact with, honor, and care for appropriately other girls around him who are friends, who are there as sisters in Christ? What does that look like? And so we really try to give this vision for where you're going and what does this look like now?
Yeah.
So that's where we're going, and then the final part is, how do you get there?
Yeah. And let me just because you said something I thought was really good that I hope people pick up on, and that is when you talked about the end of that time of teaching the students, that high school senior came to me and said, nobody ever told me this. And I think we make assumptions that just by being with young people and having them grow up in Christian homes, that somehow by osmosis they're going to absorb all this. And it's true, they do. But with a cultural narrative being so loud, so pervasive, so compelling, so convincing, teaching in the opposite direction, we really have to go out of our way to spell it out.
That's right.
It's not just our deeds that kids learn from as they watch and live with us, but it's what we say.
And I think that's so important.
We have to say it. Yeah.
So important. You know, and what's interesting is, if I break down different qualities of a godly man and ask them to identify, do you know anyone who you can think of who's a good example of this? Most of them can think of someone who's a good example of that trait. But as you said, well, they're being bombarded all around them with what they should or shouldn't be doing as a man culturally. They need explicit instruction. They're hungry for it. They want to know. You know, in our culture, there is a strong push to shame typical male virtue and courage. There's, you know, educationally, we could look at a whole bunch of different things, but where young boys are discouraged from typical male patterns and encouraged to be more like women, more feminine virtues. Guys want to know, what am I supposed to be? What does God say a man is supposed to be? So they're hungry for this, and we need to be very explicit and deliberate and repetitive in casting this vision. I really agree with that.
So where we're going now,
that's where we're going. How do we get there? And what I try to break down is, okay, we've got this foundation of a heart that fears the Lord, a heart that is marked by the characteristics of wisdom. We're headed towards godly manhood. What are the specific traits that are going to prepare us for godliness and leadership? And what I find interesting is that if you look at sort of the key themes of Proverbs, so obviously Proverbs covers a whole range of different topics, but if you were to sort of boil down and say, what are sort of the key topics you hear about over and over again in Proverbs, you hear things like self-control. You hear things like humility. You hear things about how you treat other people, seeking peace You hear things like work, hard work. You hear you hear some of these key themes coming up in Proverbs. Where if you take, I think, a typical book on either manhood or in leadership, you're going to hear a lot of similar things: sacrifice and humility, self-control, seeking peace, and how to resolve conflict with others. How do you make decisions? Proverbs really, I think, becomes a key curriculum. And there's really five areas that I really focus on. Self-control, as opposed to self-expression, that really hits that cultural narrative of self-gratification and self-expression head on. Self-control to decision-making. And decision-making really brings up two things. One, how do we sort of make the daily decisions, the daily decisions of integrity that would impact us now? But then also, how do you make big decisions? As a young man, these high school boys, they've got college decisions, they've got job decisions, they've got big decisions coming up to them.
Can I say something about that?
Yeah.
I'm glad you addressed that. This is timely. I just pulled a picture up on my computer. One of our associate staff guys, Paul Robertson, who's up in Canada, he was in North Carolina, and they went to a place to eat, and outside was this. I know people can't see this, but it was one of these blackboards that had stuff on there with a Corona Extra logo on there, and it said the restaurant had used chalk to put this on: forecast for tonight, alcohol, low standards, and poor decisions.
Yeah, sounds about right.
And he was saying, this is kind of the mantra for people now.
Yep.
Yeah, so this is good to push back. This is a great example of how the biblical narrative speaks to the cultural narrative and where the cultural narrative sends us in wrong ways, in destructive ways. So
that's right. So we really focus self-control, decision-making. Focus on peacemaking and conflict resolution. And maybe this is one that doesn't immediately come to mind for some people, but there's a couple things we see that we're losing some of the soft skills of relating to people. And our cultural narrative that's focused on individualism, self-gratification, and self-expression, if you don't agree with me, I'm out. The more we interact on screens and the less we interact as people, the more we lose the ability to peacemake, to work through conflict resolution. But if you think of what does it mean to be a man, he's going to have a wife, he's going to have children, he's going to be working a job. What does it mean to be in the church and to be a leader in the church? If you can't resolve conflict, if you don't have a peacemaking spirit, you're really cutting the heart out of being a man and a leader. So we focus on that. We focus on discipleship in leading and influencing others. And one of the things I tell our young men a lot is leadership, when you boil it down, is influence. It's influence. And as a high school young man, there are many people you influence and are able to influence. And so we really look at, okay, what does it look like to start being intentional about influencing and leading junior high boys in our youth group? Younger students in our elementary Sunday school classes, your peers around you. How do you begin to take that influence in leadership now? And then lastly, perseverance and realizing that your walk with the Lord and your growth in both holiness and in leadership is a long-term process. So what does it look like not to just really work hard on something for a week, but to have a long-term vision in life for serving the Lord and growing in these ways? So this is really kind of the keys of where we go here. We start with the heart of wisdom, foundation of the fear of the Lord, and these pillars of listening, trusting the Lord, and guarding our heart. We look at where we're going. What does the Bible cast as the vision to be a godly man? And then what are the specific traits that are going to start to train our hearts to get there?
You mentioned Proverbs a lot, and I try to spend a lot of time in Proverbs myself. Mm. Are there any resources that would be really helpful to youth workers and parents on that?
On the wisdom side.
On the wisdom side and maybe the book of Proverbs. I mean, I'm thinking of Keller's book on Proverbs.
Tim Keller's book, which is that
devotional book, which, man, that's a great one to go through over the course of a year. Even as parents, if we would just go through that, maybe hit on some of those things at dinner time.
I think that's one of the best resources, and I've recommended that to high school students. A lot of high school students are looking for a devotional that they can read through that'll have them in the Word of God, but they don't want to read something really long. There you have short wisdom from Proverbs on a daily basis. I think that's an excellent resource. There's also a resource for younger students. If you're a parent or a youth worker, maybe you're overseeing sort of elementary, late elementary age by Marty Makowski, called The Way of Wisdom. And that's a Proverbs devotional on wisdom aimed at sort of the elementary to late elementary time frame.
That's one so, I haven't heard of.
That one's really excellent. We're just finishing that with our own kids right now. So those are great devotional types of material. There's tons of material on sort of the more academic side of wisdom that's really rich. But I think those two are really practical daily resources.
So let's finish up here with, I know that you have thought about, what can I pass on from my mm-hmm. dissertation here to parents? What can I pass on to youth workers?
Yeah.
There's one that jumps out at me, and I noticed it when you gave me an outline of what you had written mm-hmm. that ties into a little bit of what you just said, and that is, do we treat our students as immature kids or as mature adults in training?
Yep.
And when you mentioned giving the Keller book to high school students, I anticipate the pushback based on some of the questions I get. What's a good devotional to give to middle school students or high school students on this, that, or the other thing?
Mm-hmm.
And implicit in that question is, kids can't handle adult things,
right.
Which goes back
right.
to what we talked about in the beginning
right.
about expectations. You know,
right.
when we set the bar low, we're going to hit a low. We
That's
may
right.
hit the bar low, but
That's
when
right.
we set the bar high, talk about that, because I know at Westminster mm-hmm. you've done that.
I if there was anything that I would want to pass on, it's just a strong encouragement in this direction. And that is, how do we treat students? What are we expecting? I still remember a seventh grade student, was a student I taught at Veritas Academy. And years later, they told me, I never forgot the first time you talked to me, because an adult had never talked to me like another adult before. And there's something just in the way you approach someone. Are you treating them as someone who deserves our attention and our respect? Or are you treating them as someone who's immature and I'm going to sort of lower myself down to that level? I had a student in our youth group who was sharing with me about visiting other youth groups. And he was sharing how he visited another youth group that was talking about the importance of reading God's word. And he said, in many ways, the content of what he said was excellent. And it's a lot of the stuff you've told us, and it was really encouraging. But he said the entire presentation was morbidly immature. He said, I couldn't count the number of poop jokes that were made in the middle of this talk. And what was striking was you can have excellent content.
Yeah.
But if you're presenting it to kids feeling like you need to dumb down and be immature to be like them, you're actually reinforcing this cultural narrative that immaturity, irresponsibility, and youth is where it's at. It's where the kids should be, rather than calling them the other way. In our youth group, and there's lots of pros and cons to this. I'm not saying it's the right way to do things, but we have all of our 7th through 12th grade students together in one youth group time. And I'm very explicit about challenging our senior high students that they set the tone for the youth group. And what I find is the senior high students bring the middle school students up. I just don't deal with nearly as much of the sort of junior high immaturity. Now, we've got plenty, but the whole atmosphere, I think, is really encouraged, challenged, and grows in maturity and responsibility by treating our students that way, setting a tone for that environment, having our senior high leaders set that tone in that environment, and expecting that kids can do more, can serve in more ways, can engage in more mature conversations. And I think that sets a tone and really fights back against some of this in a really profound and practical way.
Yeah. As you say that, I'm thinking back over the course of my own life in ministry. And now that I'm, 40-some years into it, and I go back to the beginning as a youth worker, and I think this still happens, in the late 1970s, we just believed that, by and large, kids didn't want to talk about spiritual things, so there was a bit of an entertainment mm-hmm. component. And even when you gave a talk, mm-hmm. you were instructed, if you're going to talk for 20 minutes or half an hour, spend the first half at least, or the first 10 minutes, drawing students in with some funny stuff, mm-hmm. Some mm-hmm. stuff that we understood mm-hmm. maybe wrongly was more on their level. And I think what we were doing was affirming, in many ways, immaturity and mm-hmm. undermining our own ability to communicate mm-hmm. well by presenting ourselves as less mature as we probably should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say probably should have been, that's an admission that maybe we were less mature than we thought we were,
Sure.
And then you somehow sneak a truth in. And over the course of those years, I've seen that continue along with an acknowledgement that the capacity of a young person to deal with difficult things or more mature things has diminished, mm-hmm. and the time component mm-hmm. that you can engage them with mm-hmm. has diminished as mm-hmm. well. That's shortened.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's a common misunderstanding, I believe, because now that I'm older, still talking to students about mm-hmm. difficult matters and things that are important, and I'll give you a great example, talking about pornography and human sexuality. You know, as 62 years old with hair that's gray, I can't, there's nothing I can do visually mm-hmm. to impress a young person, mm-hmm. but I can treat them as an adult.
That's right. Yeah.
And when I start these conversations with groups of kids, I will begin by saying, let's make some assumptions. Let's agree on a few things. And one of the mm-hmm. first ones is, I'm going to speak to you adult to adult. Mm-hmm. And I was, when I was down at Asheville Christian Academy back in the fall to speak mm-hmm. to students in chapel, the headmaster there came to me afterwards and he said, it was a great affirmation. He said, you had them as soon as you said that in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have to rely on any of this mm-hmm. crazy stuff we think we mm-hmm. have to rely on. Mm-hmm. I just had to rely on honesty and integrity mm-hmm. and hopefully communicating some wisdom that I believe comes with age. And so I really want to affirm, if we want to raise adults, we have to treat them
right.
as adults. We have to understand developmental realities.
That's right. Absolutely.
And, you know, as you said, you've got middle school immaturity there.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I'm certainly a fan of drawing people in, using stories
oh, yeah.
they can read.
Exactly.
You know, this isn't an argument against that
at
all.
Yeah.
But I think the question, as James K. Smith put it, he said, every routine and pattern you have shapes some kind of person.
Yes.
Have you thought about what kind of person your environment and your routines and your culture that you're shaping is going to, to shape?
Yeah, just to mention him, Jamie Smith, we had him on the podcast, so we'll link to that podcast. We had him talk about You Are What You Love.
Yeah.
But are you talking about like Desiring the Kingdom and some of those other books that he's written?
I don't remember
all address
which one
that
he quoted,
forms.
But it's all saying the same thing.
Yeah. Youth workers, you got to read Jamie Smith. I mean, he is really hitting this stuff pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And it all goes back to, you know, kind of McLuhan back in the early 60s, the medium is the message.
Yeah, and some of those the traits that you mentioned, self-control, decision-making, peacemaking, those types of things, in many ways, those are the habits that, you know, to
That's
use
right.
the terms of Jamie Smith, that, you know, those are the habits that we want to instill in young men so that they are pointed
right.
and grow into godly men.
Yeah, yeah, I really like this. And, you know, Chris, you really haven't gotten into this. David Kinnaman hit on some of this with us in our last podcast as we talked about where the emerging generations are in terms of their faith. But I've been alive long enough to see strategies, to buy into strategies, to enact strategies on the input side, if I can say it that way, and been around long enough now to see the output side, not only of our general efforts in youth ministry, but my specific efforts in youth ministry over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see where we did things right. I can see where we did things wrong. And this is where I can see where I did things right and I did things wrong. And this is where I really appreciate what you've done here in this project. And it's also why I hope it turns into a book. And I'm going to work to see what I can do to help that happen somehow, some way, because I think this is valuable for youth workers. Is there anything else you want to, because I know we've wound down to the end of the time here, anything else that you would want to pass on quickly to youth workers and parents as a result of what you studied and what you learned?
You know, I think we've hit on a lot of the main things. I think if I could just come back to this theme of giving students real opportunities for responsibility and service. You know, I think for them to be actively engaged in serving in the church and leading in appropriate areas in our youth ministries and in the church, to have adults who are coming alongside so that there's help, there's input, there's mentoring there, but they have real responsibility and real leadership opportunity. That's going to be tremendously powerful.
Yeah.
And even secularly, there's been a number of sort of experimental projects done even in local communities where teens and high school students are given responsibility in local communities with sort of an official person that's kind of there as a resource. Youth adult partnerships is what it's referred to, with tremendous results of interest in and involvement in the community and decision making and leadership abilities, and so just to involve them in every way that you can.
Yeah.
And real leadership and responsibility.
Before we cut off, one more thing, because we really haven't hit on this a whole lot, but and I know this, again, is a big part of what you do in ministry. You know, you and I come from a confessional church where we have strong emphasis on doctrine and statements. I think that's been diminished in the larger church. I think that, you know, I'm working with a whole generation of youth workers who see that as something antiquated. They've never experienced it. And as a result of never experiencing it, they don't see the importance of it, or nor do they know where to find it or how to deal with it. But in our cases, you know, we've had confessions, we've had catechisms, and so the content part of this is necessary. And I think we have a generation of parents and a generation of youth workers who we really need to go deep in nurturing ourselves, so in turn we can go deep in nurturing our kids and telling them that the truths about life, the joyful, life-giving, freedom-giving truths that lead to our flourishing. You were with us Friday night at our celebration banquet for CPYU. We gave out the New City Catechism,
excellent resource,
which is a great resource. And I know, I think maybe we can set that up, Chris, where folks can get that from us perhaps if they come to the website. Now that I said that, he's got to set that up to make that happen. But any other resources you would pass on to parents that you've realized would, or youth workers, that would help in our own formation and in turn the formation of our kids?
Well, I mean, as far as catechisms go, I think the New City Catechism is a great resource. It uses contemporary language. It's hitting on the key sources there. So I think that's really important. I mean, there's all sorts of resources you can look at to say, okay, how do we ground ourselves sort of in theology as a whole? I think of something like R.C. Sproul's Everyone's a Theologian, giving us sort of an introductory lay-level systematic theology in a couple hundred pages. That's just a great theological foundation.
Yeah.
You know, resources like that are really helpful.
Let me throw one more in, and Chris, maybe you have something. Jesus Storybook Bible.
Yeah, great.
Because we're, you know, we're recording this, excuse me, during Easter week.
There you go.
And Lisa and I, we have snuggle time with our two twin grandkids. They're 5 years old, Lucy and Nolan. And the other night during snuggle time, we read from the Jesus Storybook Bible several stories on Passion Week, you know, the whole week leading up to and then the death and resurrection of Christ. And it was fascinating just to see these five-year-olds engaged, asking some really interesting questions that were difficult to answer. Is God married? Is God Jesus's grandfather? Because, you know, Joseph was his father. So is God Jesus? I mean, those, man, when your grandkids ask those questions, you know, you're like, okay, how do I frame this in a way? But the beauty of the Jesus Storybook Bible is it takes kids into those. And Sally Lloyd-Jones has done a great job of helping us communicate well. So that would be another one I'd recommend. You know, again, youth workers and parents, nurture yourselves. That's key. That's key.
Yeah.
Well, good. I am thrilled, Chris, that you came and you joined us and that we had this conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invitation.
Anything else you want to say, parting words or any other resources you'd point to? Was there one book when you did this that was just knock you out really good?
That I enjoyed the most personally was the one I already mentioned by Cetrin and Kiesling on spiritual formation in emerging adulthood. That was probably the one that I personally enjoyed the most, felt like I grew the most and found the most sort of dovetailing with my heart for this project and where I was headed.
Yeah.
I felt like they were on the same page and tracking in the same direction.
That's a good recommendation. Were there pictures in that book? Is that
no pictures?
Okay,
no pictures.
That's impressive that you went after a book with no pictures. So I like that. That's good.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Chris Wagner, thanks for sitting over there and controlling everything today. We appreciate that. And for everybody listening, check out the podcast page. If you're listening on other players like Apple Podcasts or whatnot, come back to cpyu.org. Look for episode 81, 81, 81, And beneath the player, you will find links that Chris Wagner has posted to everything that we've talked about today, so you can access all of those things. And we'd ask you as well, if you're listening to the podcast on another player or another podcast platform, give us a good review. That's helpful to us. And as always, you can subscribe to Youth Culture Matters wherever you access your podcasts. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.